revolution. Well, you know, we don't want to change the world. Tell me that's evolution. Well, you know, we don't want to change the world. When you talk about destruction, don't you know what you can count me? Solution, well, you know, we'd love to see the flag. You ask for a contribution, well, you know, we're doing what we can. One money people mind that hate. I'll tell you, brother, have to wait. All right,
Billy Bragg and his version of Revolution here on Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. I'm Paul Rowland, your regular host every Wednesday morning, and I've got a guest in the studio, Jonathan Ogden. Good morning, Jonathan.
Hey, good morning.
And we're going to be talking about a pretty big subject here, so bear with us. The number to call in, 503-231-8187. So rent speculation and the selling off of Portland is the theme. A perfect capitalist storm of tax breaks, opportunity zones, PERS speculation, earthquake building codes and policies, and the new rent derivatives market. Big piece to chew off. So you all came together. You're a part of a Portland Assembly, which has been around 2-3 years and is kind of working to get together neighborhoods in a grassroots assemblies to the end of mutual aid networks and such. And but this group here, as I understand it, you've got a little research group going that's looking into all these questions and taking you in unexpected directions, perhaps, got together basically around this, the last October, I guess, the city council passed a ordinance on the unreinforced masonry buildings to require them to label them. That they're unsafe, may be unsafe in the event of earthquake, and that's coming up this March 1st. And then NAACP-led coalition, and I guess musicians?
Music Portland's a part of that one Music as well.
Right, they're a part of that coalition, okay, mm-hmm. that got together and protested this and said that it was an unfair, discriminatory policy for a number of reasons. So bring that first piece together. Why did that bring you all together?
Sure. So previous to this, something that at least myself and members of the group have been very interested in as kind of a predicate to this was this notion of the growth coalition, right? There's this guy, Madroff, who's a professor at UC Santa Cruz. He has a theory about growth coalition that basically talks about the city, the land owners, and the developers all being in conjunction to drive prices of land upwards because they all make money off of it implicitly. And this has kind of been the way it is for a long time. And
so that's not like actually it's not actually an existing group, the Growth Coalition. It's a sort of it's a concept.
Yeah, but the irony is that we have people like Ted Wheeler as a part of these business coalitions called Up for Growth. So the proxy is very thin.
And so this goes pretty far back, this idea, this loose affiliation of, you know, Chamber of Commerce types, builders, mm-hmm. et cetera. Yeah,
there's a long history in Portland. You can kind of see through the history. There's a lot of land grabs going on, things like that, throughout the development in Portland. This is kind of a new iteration of that as far as we can tell, but that's what brought us together at first was this NAACP-led coalition about this issue that we were already interested in because of how much it contributed to the way in which speculative pricing was pretty much bubbling the land economy as far as that goes. And that gets a little bit more insidious considering this, I think, is a national thing. This isn't just us here in Portland. It's kind of affecting lots of cities, actually.
So, yeah, people talk about gentrification, obviously, which is a manifestation. Does gentrification, as we know it, have a particular history? Does it fit into this? You know, it's obviously been going on a long time. I guess it goes back to urban renewal, I guess, is an earlier term.
Yeah.
So, play, Talk a little bit about that history, I guess.
Oh, that's actually a pretty interesting history. I'm more aware of the recent developments in that history because of the work I had done with the neighborhood associations, actually. A lot of those had been formed in response and resistance to a lot of the federal investment in highways and freeway passes and things like that that were obviously targeted towards, you know, North Portland, historically Black Portland, and especially considering Vanport and how that all went down, and basically the city straight up ignored people's, you know, requests for help after they knew this was going to happen, after they were aware the levees weren't necessarily going to hold. So there's a history of negligence and exclusion that obviously has a racial profile here in Portland. So that's kind of the precedent, right? And so gentrification itself is kind of a debatable term, but through this research, there's been a pretty good coalescence around a certain figure that you can look at. And I believe actually the PALF report, the Portland African American Leadership Foundation, they had done a people's plan that was pretty comprehensive that touched on this a bit. But if you dig into the economic math, you can see there's a ratio between the building price and the land price. And that differential there kind of shows you how likely it would be that it would be torn down instead of rehabilitated or so on. So even if it were habitable, even if it were somewhere you could live and there were actually spaces already built that were affordable, because this is, we don't have a housing crisis, right? We have a rent crisis. That means that the prices don't suit the economy here. People can't afford them, so on and so forth. And you keep hearing this real reductive argument, this supply and demand argument. Build, 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 build. We need more supply. The supply keeps coming and the price keeps swinging up. So obviously this isn't working and it hasn't worked for anybody else. So this is the conversation we need to talk about.
So you're saying,
sorry, that's a lot. Yeah.
No, we've got a lot of threads going here. To talk about this, this idea that we supposedly have this housing crisis, and actually not all the, I guess that gets to the occupancy rate. So you know, you look around, you see these big box buildings going up all over these, you know, two, three, four story buildings that occupy a half a city block or a whole city block. You know, in this neighborhood where we are in Southeast Portland, there's a lot of them, and that's supposedly, you know, to address the issue that, you know, all these people are coming to Portland. Portland is becoming this kind of boom town. But you're saying beneath the surface, that all those buildings are not actually being occupied, that people are not actually moving in and filling up those buildings. Is that true?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, and people would wonder why, and it's even come from different threads. I mean, there was a thread on one of the local organizers from PTU's, you know, Facebook page about some of the provisions for the statewide rent control thing, which is basically just a guarantee of doubling in 10 years, right? 7% annual return will double in 10 years. That's how that whole thing works, exponential curves, right? So those kinds of discussions are going on, and there are some people who don't seem to understand why that would be a problem, I suppose. They don't see that people would ever do that, would ever have a place empty and just own it, because they're understanding this landlord game as an income based off of the rents that you're actually selling. So we'll get into that, but in fact what we have now is a completely different demand signal that's driving this, that is basically the same as the one driving the Wall Street stock markets. You know, we're actually publicly trading rents now as of 2017, when these corporate landlords went public last year, or 2 years ago now.
So publicly trading, how does that work?
So this would require we kind of step back a little bit and start at the financial crash, right? Which I know is relevant for Portland. I'm sure that people have a lot of anecdotal information about what happened during 2007, 2008 in Portland. But the start of this was the same mechanism that drove the mortgage-backed securities crash, right? And if everyone listening doesn't recall, that was this idea that you could issue these loans that weren't that good, and then you could package them in derivatives that were hedged. So if it went up, it would go up. If it went down, it would go up. And those were all packaged together in a new package called a derivative that had so many inputs going up and down, it was effectively stable. And they rated it AAA, and it was supposed to be the best thing. And obviously that's probably a gross oversimplification, but the gist of it is that they were selling bad loans as a thing that weren't called loans. And we didn't do anything about that. Legally speaking, the bailout happened, 2011 happened, the TARP bailout happened, Ben Bernanke, the then federal chair or whatever, he advised that to stabilize the rental market or stabilize the housing market generally, after all these homes just got foreclosed, millions of people in California out of a home in tent cities, and I don't know if everyone remembers how bad that was for a little while.
We're still obviously living in the aftermath. Things have never really gotten back to, quote, normal, whatever normal is.
This is kind of why I wanted to come talk to you, actually, because this, I don't think we ever recovered. This seems to have been a continuous smokescreen since that period in order to maintain the image of a functioning economy, while the people who had the control basically fleeced everyone and started siphoning off most of the value of the U.S. dollar before it started falling out of favor, because, you know, internationally speaking, we're getting a little tenuous, right? So,
okay, these are the really big level things that we're gonna, you know, sort of keep getting back to. But I just want to back up once again. So we, you know, you're in 2008 and this mortgage derivative issue to kind of leading up to talk about how what they're doing with rents now is a similar move, because basically, you know, as we talked earlier before we went on the air, the hyper-capitalist economy, whatever it is, late-stage capitalism, end-stage capitalism, whatever, is based upon these, you know, these speculative, well, they become bubbles. I guess people hope that they want to get whatever out of them they can before it crashes. I don't know if that's their psychology, but that's usually what results, you know, the dot-com bubble, the mortgage, there's an endless series of them, because basically what people are doing is they're finding ways to invest these huge pools of capital in a way that they can make even more money. And then when it falls out, they go on to the next one. So there's been a long series of them. Anyway, I just want to get back before we talk more specifically about this rent speculation you're getting into. So the thing that just, I mean, if you stop and think about these things, they really get you, because you know, when I learned about, how redlining worked, like, you know, in Portland specifically, you know, this basically not extending credit to classes of people, in this case, largely African Americans, and basically making it really difficult for people, to get a mortgage on their house, to buy a house, whatever. And that went on for years and years and years. And then it kind of, I'm sure it's way more complicated, but over a certain period of time, it kind of flipped, and they decided that when they decided to do this mortgage derivatives, there's this really easy credit, in some cases too easy credit, and then the result, the fallout from it was a lot of African Americans and poor people lost out again, because they had these loans that they got that then were bundled up, and that the whole economy crash and they got foreclosed on. Anyway, long story short, so now, you know, when we have, after that happened, and in this massive exodus from the, you know, the heart of the Black community in North Northeast Portland, scattered around, I guess, a lot to the, you know, Gresham and East Portland, now you've got this new mechanism, which we're going to talk about a little more in detail, the fact that the Portlandia has been sort of become this magnet city, you know, for the, you know, the selling of Portland has been this, you know, through not just through the TV show, through all kinds of depictions of Portland as this hip place. It's got this image of being this sort of hipster paradise, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, obviously there are people moving to Portland because there are climate refugees, there are economic refugees, there are whatever. There is a population increase happening. And so there is a need to deal with that issue. But that's not what's happening. What's happening is this other thing. So talk more about the rent derivatives market.
No, that's totally reasonable. I mean, me, myself, personally, I have a sneaking suspicion that this all has to do with New York, right? Because if it has to do with Wall Street, I'm sure they have some media contacts and they could get a few propaganda pieces put out. But that's kind of what makes this whole thing suspicious, even circling back, right? So the popularization of this place where young people come to retire, coinciding with a lot of the Pearl projects going under during the 2008 crash, where a lot of people probably had their money in the buildings and weren't necessarily sure they're going to get it back out. And then comes the TARP bailout in 2011, which, like we were saying, it's created this opportunity for Wall Street, through Ben Bernanke saying to stabilize things, to overnight become the biggest landlords in the U.S. And so, circling back to Vanport and so on, like, let's talk about the history a little bit of what I know about Black Portland as far as how the displacement went. So from its inception, right, from the colonial expansion in the 1850s, because Oregon was a late territory, there was the outset of it being a kind of white utopia, and that's been documented numerous times. You can see it's still in the racist deed restrictions. There's a lot of, you know, stuff on the books until recently, like that whole lash law thing, that kind of thing was just historically how the character of Oregon was formed. So a lot of people from Missouri, which was one of the last holding states of slavery, moved to Oregon, which is why it was such a problem at the time. I think it's like 1840s. But in any case, like, we start there with the takeover of the indigenous people's land. And then you get to the World Wars, right? So the World Wars are when they needed the labor of the African-American community, and they started that whole Vanport community for that purpose.
And others. A lot of Native American people moved from other parts of the country here, too.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure other communities as well.
Well, yeah. That's an interesting point, right? Because this was also a dump site for the Trail of Tears, I believe. There are lots of people who have been disenfranchised ending up on this coast. So really, this is kind of an interesting backdrop for this final grasp, because I really do think this is the end. I think this is capitalists abandoning the U.S. economy, because they have no reason to invest in productive economy now. They haven't,
because it's all speculative at this point.
The major
driving force of the global economy, the U.S. economy, well, I guess China, you know, these emergent economies are exceptions, although they're doing the same thing, I guess, in their own way, but. Yeah, it's all based on this model of finding new ways of speculating on capital, whether it's speculating on money itself, on currencies, on all these other, you know, these derivatives markets, futures markets, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, quick aside, you know, shout out for my real nerds. There's a Levy Institute paper that talks about the transition from industrialized capitalism to financialized bubble economy. And that's kind of the real scary thing here, is most of the gains in the national economy have come from finance and real estate. So just this kind of magicking numbers into productivity. So it literally seems like we've kind of tanked our economy already, and this is the smokescreen to keep things afloat so people don't take to the streets, you know, because if people took to the streets over Donald Trump getting elected, if they actually figured out what's going on and the connection to Kushner and Blackstone and Wheeler all together, they would probably get a little upset.
Okay, well, we'll bracket that.
Yeah.
We still haven't fully explained the rent derivatives market, and you just introduced the name Blackstone, which we got to get into, and the connection to Ted Wheeler, et cetera. But we do have a caller already. Let's go to Jeremy right now. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hello?
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, let's go back to Jeremy in a second. He'll get back to the phone. Okay, so just finish the rent derivatives. You said it just started. It's a whole new thing. Just started last year or 2 years ago.
Well, so they never did anything about derivatives markets. I believe that was a new thing in the 2000s era when it became the...
Right.
Yeah. So they never did anything to stop that. And my understanding now is that there are just literal derivatives for every kind of debt. Car loans, student debt, the loans that the school took out to do development. Like, literally every kind of debt has a derivative now, as far as I can understand. So, and maybe that's wrong. Maybe somebody call in and correct me, but there are a lot of them, and they are not regulated. And we are in the midst of a coordinated seeming government shutdown that's all too conveniently aligned with a number of tax breaks with these opportunity zones and so on. But the rent derivatives are just based around the changes in the rent price. These people don't have to fill these things. So the incentive is to game the system by taking a plot of land that used to have a $250,000 house on it and building the biggest possible thing you can, because it increases the value of the land for the city. They get higher taxes. It increases the profit margin for the developer, because it's all luxury and that's what they want to make the most money with, right? Because this demand signal, quote unquote, that's being driven by Wall Street says that they should build it. It's just the logic of capitalism. It's driving itself into the ground because they don't understand that land itself is not a commodity. You can't go start a land factory and bring down the price of land. The only thing that's ever regulated the price of land, in fact, is the use of military force to displace indigenous people. That's the foundation of this problem. So it's effectively gentrification, to answer your question, summed up, is the modern era of colonization. It's the modern phase of colonialism.
Okay, so we've got these rent derivatives. Well, let's see. We got a couple callers, so let's go to that. We'll get back to these opportunity zones because we haven't explained that, which arose out of the 2017 tax overhaul. So that'll be the next subject to get into. But let's go to, hopefully, Jeremy's back. Are you there, Jeremy?
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello, sorry. Yeah. I wanted to give an example, and I speak as a landlord. Although, you know, one that's always below market, I hope, or, you know, well below market. Anyway, they tore down the end of my block. There was a nice house worth, you know, maybe $350 that they just put $8,000 of cabinets in there. And then there was this horrible motorcycle museum shop and then a storage lot. So it was about 2.5 lots. And they tore that down a year and a half ago. Homes by Andre. He drives a Lamborghini. He's infamous in the West Hills for being very rich, very evil, and very good at what he does. And his plan was to build 35 one-bedrooms. He paid $1.1 million for it. 35 one-bedrooms with 7 parking spots. As someone who hates cars and doesn't drive, I can't believe that I'm saying this, but I was horrified at the idea of 35 apartments with only 7 parking spaces, because there would be no parking for my tenants. The restaurant down the street from me, you know, gave notice the minute they heard the plan. Anyway, it's a year and a half now. They haven't built anything, because if he tries to build 35 one bedrooms, they'll go empty like everything else. And guess how much that land is now for sale for? I thought it would be, you know, less than what he paid for it. It's for sale for $2.9 million.
Yes.
I have no idea how that works.
This is the exact problem we're talking about.
Yeah, so it this is clearly, it's like fracking. It doesn't have any real value. It's like the internet bubble. It's like these derivatives. You know, it's artificial money, and you can buy it, and you can sell it, and you can get rich off of it, and it's evil. So I'm going to end with a quote from an anarchist, which is, it's only 3 words, from Pierre Paul Proudhon. Property is theft.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Get no arguments here, I think.
Duly noted.
Right, well, thank you, Colin.
Anyway, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you for calling
really
in.
And really good show.
Thank you. Real quick, just because you mentioned it, I kind of want to talk about that a little bit. There is a thing that we've been passing around from Strongtown's blog. That I don't agree with everything they have on there. Charles Marone's kind of a capitalist, but they do highlight the nature of this problem, which, in fact, the UN has called out. The UN has put out a few papers now. One from 2014 sticks out, but it just says that land should not be treated as a commodity. You should stop selling houses as a commodity. It's ruining society. And you can go look that up if you want.
It's about time.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you think they'd catch up. Wow, you know, the UN. Everybody, give them a round of applause. But the thing about this land pricing is that it's through the county mechanism. And so it's a 3% return if you don't do anything to the land, right? And so that's already kind of screwy, because 3% is going to double in about 20 years. So just by holding the land as a property owner, you can price out a generation, right? So when you develop the land, though, if I recall, there's not really a cap. It's based off of the relative maximum value assessed and the previously assessed value. So what happens when you get less land then? Oh, well, we have less data to work with for the previously assessed value. So now we're going based off the maximum value assessed. And that kind of brings up the point that we had our caller make, right? I figured that land would depreciate. You know, it makes sense. Why are we going to need it? No, not under this tax system where it's incentivized by the city structure, which is a colonial extension of the main, you know, colonizing entity. Driven by finance, so they're expected to return on something, and the returns they're getting are on land now. So there's no more money in productivity and building factories and training workers and getting all that stuff done. You just have to hold on to stuff at this point and maybe build some more stuff that's worth more in that area. So not to digress too far, but when that $250,000 house has a $1.5 million condo built right next to it, the value of that empty plot that's where we're seeing the most ridiculous gain. And it's also what drives the incentive for teardown. So effectively what you see is that there are these locus sites where the ripple effect of the value will move outwards to all the properties. So if you look at the maps of these overlays, the city has strategic properties in places, it seems. The URM map has really strategic properties, it seems, because it overlays pretty much exactly with the opportunity zone that gives you the most possible tax deference.
Okay, well, we haven't actually explained opportunity
zones. Yeah, you're right.
Which I'm gonna read a little bit from this. So welcome to Tax Breaklandia article, which came out a while ago on Bloomberg.com. But we do have Sean. Let me just, before we get to Sean, remind people that the number is 503-231-8187. And I'm talking with Jonathan Ogden with the Portland Assembly and his little crack affinity group that's doing a lot of research into this this capitalist web of finance and profit making. So let's go to Sean. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, guys. Great conversation. So it must have been a couple years ago. I called into KBOO when they were discussing the housing crisis. And my comment was something to the effect about the labor union movement and how you know, membership in unions is just declining and declining. And after I hung up, to my astonishment, one of the guests said something to the effect of, "What do labor unions have to do with the housing crisis?" So that's getting to a larger point that I want to make this morning, is that underlying all this seems to be the fact that the American people, we are essentially a broken people. When you lose class consciousness, you are essentially co-opted and broken by the dominant power. Someone on this network recently even said that, well, they support capitalism because it is, in essence, a meritocracy, and you get what you deserve. So, like, it's the exact opposite of a psychology of solidarity, all for one, one for all. The meritocracy psychology is like, well, you know, we're all individual competitors and you get what you deserve. So as a broken people our very minds have been co-opted by the capitalist class, there's absolutely no way to fight back. And of course, social Democrats who insist on like universal class conscious language, we're not trusted by people of color because people of color were betrayed during the New Deal and the GI Bill. They didn't benefit from any of that. And so they insist on language of intersectionality and identity politics. And so we're a broken population. We have no means of defending ourselves anymore. And the housing crisis is simply one more reflection of that. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Well, fair enough. That's a bleak. But still, yet we breathe and are able to talk on the radio. You want to respond to that before we go on?
Oh, just quickly, I want you to read that, but to answer you, I hear you, and that's kind of why we're going with the popular assembly method. And I mean, if we look to northern Mexico and Chiapas and other places where they have this more rotating leadership model of federation, I think you can actually have a good example of resisting this kind of economy in the northern hemisphere. But also, you're right, like, this is an exponential growth problem, right? People are probably laughing at me right now, but this is the issue. Like, you don't know that it's too late until it's too late if you think about it as a linear problem, because the last minute is when you're going to have something go halfway full and then double, right? So it's already too late because of exponential growth and how it works. So this exponential decay of the economy, you need to have a concomitant exponential increase in political consciousness, in class consciousness. And that's not going to happen through this atomized, individualized topology, right? So this individual competitor strategy won't work. There's actually a good Aon article about this, if you go look it up. Talks about the strength of global connections being dependent on local networks. So small groups of cooperators federating in this model of the prisoner's dilemma will always win out against individuals competing in the same exact computer model. So they've kind of studied this already. Small federated groups, if you want to try and fight this, that's what we're talking about. Like, this is the end. Like, this is their end game. They're just squeezing the last bit of value out. Like, go start an affinity group. Go start anything with your friends, like two or three people you trust, and start federating. Because otherwise, you're right. It's over with the same method. We're not going to win with that method. It's not going to happen.
So back to the opportunity zones. and how they relate to the unreinforced masonry buildings that we were talking about, and to the, well, we haven't gotten to PERS yet, but hopefully we will, or Blackstone. Okay, Portland is about to see a flurry of construction because of a provision in the 2017 tax overhaul that led to the creation of more than 8,700, quote, opportunity zones across the country, areas that, in theory, have been ignored by investors and need generous tax breaks to catch up. But Oregon did an audacious thing. It selected the entire downtown of its largest city to be eligible for the law's suite of benefits, as well as neighborhoods such as the Pearl District, where the new high-rises loom over old industrial spaces converted into, quote, creative offices and boutique furniture stores, sit near juice bars serving acai bowls. The Central East Side, an area that Portland's Alt Weekly crowned the city's best food neighborhood, is also included. And that's us right here at KBOO in the middle of that Central East Side. That's turning the city of about 650,000 into a microcosm of what critics see as one of the biggest problems with opportunity zones. Among a nationwide patchwork of struggling areas, there are a small number of thriving communities that may draw an outsized share of investors' cash. In some cases, the law may boost returns on investments that would have happened anyway. Some projects, quote, could get more money than entire states, says Brett Theodos, a senior researcher at the Urban Institute who has studied the policy. And then it goes into some more some specifics about this. Anyway, you can check this out. There's a link to it on my program page, Wednesday Talk Radio at kbo.fm. And so, yeah, well, first of all, why would, because the idea of the of this provision for these opportunity zones is they've got to have a certain percentage of low-income residents. So why does downtown Portland qualify?
Ooh, that one's super interesting, and I would want to double back because we also didn't necessarily complete that history of North Portland, but it's much more relevant to this discussion anyway because of the way that URM is effectively a shady institution of individualized redlining, as far as I can tell. So Vanport, right, the wars happened, so on. They built this community. 1948, I believe that flood happened. They did nothing. They ignored people. They basically tried to let people leave on their own as best as possible. They didn't. They recombined. They basically were only allowed to buy property in North Portland for the longest time. And even through that process, there was a lot of, you know, disenfranchisement through taxes and through loans and so on. And so that's why the NAACP is up in arms right now. A lot of these historically black churches in North Portland, they basically got 48 hours notice. And this is kind of an ongoing history here. If you look at things like Bleeding Albina and
48 hours notice for what?
About the placarding.
And okay, so let's talk about that a little more. I'm not sure. I think I wrote that down somewhere that, okay, so the issue is that, okay, city council in October pass this ordinance saying that all these unreinforced masonry buildings, there's several thousand in all over Portland, are going to have to, as of March 1st, in a little over a month, going to have this placard reading, this is an unreinforced masonry building. Unreinforced masonry buildings may be unsafe in the event of a major earthquake. And so what's the problem with that placard?
I mean, aside from the fact that it's propaganda in concomitance with that piece that Steve Novick's cousin wrote, the placard itself isn't necessarily...
The piece in New Yorker magazine, which I actually have in front of me, called The Really Big One, An Earthquake Will Destroy a Sizable Portion of the Coastal Northwest, The Question Is When, by Catherine Schultz. That's a cousin of Novick, you say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you congratulate her on the Pulitzer she got for it. Yeah, so convenient, right? But I don't know for sure, but that's odd. But the thing about it is that it basically puts an encumbrance on the title. And what's kind of sketchy is that, from what I can tell reading through the language, it looks like the kind of legalese you would use for signing your deed over to the city. And that's basically what they say, is that they're going to take possession of your property in the name of public safety via eminent domain, which is the same kind of thing that they used in North Portland to just straight up take properties to build the hospital, to build the freeway. You know, that was the fight in the 70s when the neighborhood associations were formed, was against this eminent domain problem. And so this is a similar but more shady implementation of that same exact type of thing, which is exactly the same as, you know, 40 acres and a mule. We're going to take this territory from all these native people. It's the exact same mechanism. And they monetize it. So in this case, what they're doing is saying, hey, you have a brick building. It's not safe. You need to do these retrofits. Here's what you need to do. But it just so happens that these are the most cost prohibitive retrofits. There aren't any provisions for the building owners at this time to basically do this on their own. If your building is put on this list or you get a lien because of fines not being paid, so it's not exactly a lien right away. It's like a slow burn lien, right? If you can't pay the fines, then they can put a lien on your property in actuality. So that's where they're being a bit furtive, and there's emails back and forth with the NAACP where they don't really want to answer. And the kicker to this too is at that October meeting, Nick Fish basically walked out and contacted somebody in the media to go on record as being against this. So if you want to look that up and bring it up, or someone else in the audience can, Nick Fish didn't want to do this. Chloe didn't like it. So it was not necessarily something that sat well with the rest of council, which is what brings Wheelie a bit more into the foreground about this, right? Wheeling and dealing.
Okay. So we're going to have to get more into the Ted Wheeler connection. And again, the Blackstone, the big corporation that's buying up so much property and is a huge driver of this rent derivative scheme, apparently. And they also relate to the PERS, the Public Employees Retirement System, or whatever it's called. But we have a couple callers, and we only have about 20 minutes left. So, Mitch, you are on the air. Join the conversation.
Yeah, this is the type of program I've been waiting on, and the kind of discussion we're having, because there are some basic concepts that I think need to be brought out as to what is behind this. And I agree, what you're saying is clarifying a lot of contemporary issues right now, like WAPITO, how it is that a piece of valuable property there, owned by Multnomah County, could be basically it wasn't sold at inflated land prices. It was given away as part of this first the Do Good Project. Homer Williams and Jordan Schnitzer were going to build a homeless integrated center on the WAPITO property, the prison that was never opened, that was built again with public money for $58 million, was given to these two oligarchs, Homer Williams and Jordan Schnitzer. It was put up for bidding. And instead of getting $58 million back, what Multnomah County got back was $4 or $5 million. And they're now going to turn it into industrial property. And I have doubts that they will turn it into industrial property, because, as your guest just mentioned, the real money is in simple speculation.
Yeah, that's actually, I'm really glad you brought up WAPITO, because I wanted to bring it up in this show, but I wasn't quite sure how. If only because it's the perfect example of kind of this abstract thing I keep talking about, where the city system itself is an extension of the European colonial project. So all of the values and all of the mechanisms and all of the valuation of things in the economy come from those principles, and they're informed by them. Even predating capitalism is this underlying eugenics culture in the United States that says you have to be constantly supreme and competing and so on, which creates this mentality of there being a necessary and vital component of a permanent underclass that continues to do your labor for you, right?
The paradigm you mentioned was that gentrification is the modern form,
correct,
of colonialism. And that paradigm clears a lot of the crowded thoughts in my mind, where different things come together because of our intuitive associations. But if we focus on that, we realize everything else is just an aspect of that. Just like everything else is an aspect of how do people who have the most money right now preserve the value of that money, is they make sure that the only effective hedge against inflation, because capitalists haven't figured out how to control inflation, is to pauperize everybody else so the value of your money increases. So it's not the Protestant work ethic of money has to be working all the time. It's the opposite of that. Take money out of circulation.
Yep, hoarding. the accumulation. Yes, that's that Marx thing, right? So, I mean, and just to quickly reiterate, because we don't have a whole lot of time, but the Wapato scenario, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's a great example because, as far as I know, since it was taken in the 1800s, that was unincorporated territory. That was just state-owned land that was a part of a state park, right?
Yeah, and it needed a corrupt Multnomah County government where Deborah Kafuri, who's known as this great friend of the disenfranchised, her cousin Trevor Kafuri is the property owner that brokered the deal.
Yeah, so look at the direct relationship. You have the, you know, the taking of that land through the Homestead Act and so on in the 1850s, and you have the holding on to it and the valuation of it, and then eventually you have the county taking that value over, and, you know, look at the irony of that, right? This whole carceral state analogy, they build up a prison on this native land, this stolen land. And so
because of the drug war, which has its own its own antecedents, and you know, and basically almost speculating on the futures market of incarceration, which didn't end up panning out for him. But anyway,
and it should make us mindful of neoliberal solutions, because
exactly.
What the neoliberal solutions proposes is that markets are the best way to overcome problems that markets have created.
Oh, and that's the thing that I come onto the show to talk about. Hopefully we get to talk about this more often, but this is legitimately the end game of capitalism. Like, the only way out of this is to have so-called Portland become an anti-capitalist city. There's no other way. Like, land isn't a commodity. We're not going to continue to delude ourselves. If we continue to go down that path, we're going to continue to give these people all the power they have, and they're going to keep doing this. So,
and you're right about New York having gone through this long ago.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Mitch. We got to let you go because we have another caller. But before we get to Paul, hold on there for just a second, because we really do talk about Ted Wheeler, PERS, and Blackstone. That piece has got to get out there.
Yeah, if only because, just to wrap up shortly about North Portland, right? They dispossessed all that territory. They started holding on to it. Well, if only because it's related.
Uh-huh.
So the city itself has the incentive to acquire property and hold on to it, as well as the ability to set the zoning, which effectively caps your maximum value assessed, right? So if it's a zoning where you can have industrial buildings, you're probably going to make more money. If you can have hotels, blah, blah, blah. And they also set the precedent by gaming the state for infrastructure projects that suit the developer projects. You often see that those things go hand in hand. So that assemblage is effectively what we could refer to as the Growth Coalition. Why does that matter? So the Growth Coalition scaled up with this new corporate incentive, wherein it did not have this Wall Street influence previously because they were separate markets. They weren't in that sector. 2011, they basically clapped up all the properties that they had just speculatively built. You know, all these McMansions that cropped up and people bought on bad loans are now very expensive rentals. So not only did they lose out on that, everyone lost their savings because people had invested their city-backed stuff and their pensions and all this stuff into derivative markets that were effectively worthless. When Ted Wheeler was Secretary of Treasury for Oregon, over $1 billion or a couple different investments, I know there's a $1 billion deal, but $1 billion worth of the retirement pensions happened to be invested in the Blackstone Group. And he met with them multiple times. You can go look up all the notes on that and so on. But he's old money also. Wheeler, Oregon is his family's town, right? Like, he's timber money. So he's effectively a direct link to this problem of colonization. He's effectively a direct descendant of the colonization that dispossessed people of their land, turned the trees into money. And he wants to turn the air into money. Like, he is the embodiment of the neoliberal problem. And his whole campaign is this kind of fictitious imagery showing up for glad handing and so on. And maybe he doesn't even necessarily know it, but he is a pawn in this game that Wall Street is playing at a national level. So the PERS investment is not unique, is the thing. Like, I had a friend text me some other stuff. Apparently in New Orleans, similar problems are happening. If you go look at these opportunity zones, so this opportunity zone thing relates to this, I think, directly. The pensions go into the derivatives, as far as I can tell. The opportunity zones are federally created, which is extra sketchy because the CEO of Blackstone is Trump's right-hand man for development. They just made a huge deal with China. So that's the connection there. Ted Wheeler is only 1 degree away from Trump, just putting that out there, everybody. But God, it's so absurd. So Kushner has been funded by Blackstone extensively. Something like $460 million worth of his real estate projects have been funded by them. So there's an intimate link there to Ivanka Trump's husband. And all of that ties up with this kind of wholesale manipulation of pension funds. And let me read off some of the stuff my friend from New Orleans had sent me, because I haven't actually verified this about Portland. But effectively what he's told me is that the lot next to him is owned by a lawyer, right? So it's basically they're able to sue the city. The city can sue itself in New Orleans, and then the lawyers can also charge exorbitant fees, like $11,000 an hour. So it seems like there's a racket amongst different levels of employee, all the way from the top of the state government or the federal government, which is now shut down, thank you, like so happens to be shut down at the same time they're implementing all these opportunity zones. Yeah, right. And there was actually a case where an appeal was already dismissed because the court couldn't handle it about an opportunity zone. So you can see there's a coordinated dysfunction here that's very sketchy. Like, this legit seems like a bad sign. If everyone remembers the crash in 2007, 2008, I kind of feel like the people who are in 2006 saying, hey, I don't know about these derivatives. But that's what it's looking like. It looks like a coordinated Republican coup to effectively clap everyone out of their property and just snap it up as best they can and create these enclaves that are going to be militarized, because the Central East Side Industrial Council, they're also making these things called business improvement districts. So you have this replication of the state opportunity zone at the micro level with these business improvement districts. And Right to Survive is right now in contest about the one in Central East Side. They have a counterproposal called Compassionate Change District. Definitely go check that out. It's ccdpdx.org, I believe. But that kind of explains the mechanisms of driving these tax incentives to develop the land that kind of create this incentive for increased policing, because what they're actually selling is the aesthetic of investment. This is a safe investment. This is a good area. It's got walkabouts. It looks like a postcard. They don't really even care if anyone lives there anymore, though.
Okay. You've just
given
us a huge...
had too much coffee. No,
it's all good. But Paul's been waiting patiently. Yeah. Let's go back to, you know, that we were making to kind of wrap up the show. But Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me here at the end. I just wanted to call in. I'm actually from southern Louisiana and have spent time in Portland. And a friend of mine let me know that this show is happening, and this is specifically the topic. And I just wanted to call in and give my... I guess experiences that I've learned here recently about these opportunity zones. Basically, like, I don't have too much experience with the New Orleans area, like the person was just saying before me, but I can speak on, like, the suburbs, you know, Metairie, Baton Rouge, areas like that. These opportunity zones that they're rolling out are just, like, these ridiculous giant tracts of land that essentially just are built to displace people from their neighborhoods and give folks, or rather investors, just basically every single tax break they can possibly ever ask for in the name of helping these neighborhoods. But it's just like, where's this money actually going? You know what I mean? Like, is it going back into the investor's pocket? Of course. And I'm just kind of freaking out here, because I'm just like, I'm trying to figure out, is this something that everyone's aware of? Am I late to the game, or are they just sneaking this under the table? I saw a couple articles where they said they were going to have one of the meetings canceled due to the shutdown on top of that.
I saw that too. No, that they're championing it. Like, this is the neoliberal. And, like, in fact, actually, a friend of mine, actually the one who's given me most of this data and this research, who's really been backboning this kind of thing, they had pointed out that in Portland, the realty groups, the developer groups, gave themselves a pat on the back for kind of exploiting this sentiment that Portland had of environmental justice and social justice. And so you'll see it reflected in the marketing campaigns of all these yes in my backyard types, right? Build, build, build. Right. If you don't like building, you hate poor people, so on and so forth. But never acknowledging the fact that if we leave this on the market inherently is going to favor these people who have control control of the market, and that's what's going on right now. Like, this whole affordable housing crisis is invented. They're gaming the whole system to build luxury stuff. Trump is in on it because he's a real estate magnate. It's probably the reason he's president. I mean, everyone's like, why is this guy? Probably because the real estate magnate's like, yo, we need to get out of here. Like, that's what it seems like. I don't...
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the one thing he's been successful at, if you want to call it that, because it's just, you know, he snatched up New York in the 80s or whatever at, like, zero cost to him. But, like, on top of that, like, I noticed, like, right before I was able to get on air, I heard you say something along the lines of, like, business improvement districts, I think is what you said, but like in this area they're titled all types of different things. Like, I know, for example, in New Orleans there's, I think, like 15 different security districts, meaning that like businesses in these areas pay out of pocket, it's a tax anyways, but it's built to hire people to come in and supplement the police force and essentially criminalize homelessness. It's just an extension of the broken windows theory on like a codified or even more codified, you know, type of scale. It's just,
yeah,
you know, like you were saying, they don't care if anyone lives there. They just want it to look nice while rich people walk through it. Also, in bigger cities in southern Louisiana, with these opportunity zones and business improvement districts are overlaid on top of each other, so they're getting double.
What?
Not to mention that they're building luxury high-end apartment buildings in both of these areas that are also short-term rentals. So a short-term rental that's a luxury apartment,
maximum
is
derivatives.
It's being given the same tax breaks, incentives, and pats on the back, like you said,
for luxury stuff that they'll make money. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, Paul, exactly. we gotta let you go because we gotta wind the show up right about now. But thanks for calling in, Elliot. I'm not sure. Well, if you have a real quick comment, we gotta wrap up. Elliot, go ahead if you have a 30-second comment.
Yeah, no, very quick for a future show, because you mentioned unreinforced masonry in the earthquake. There's this UW engineering professor who's may have solved two problems by sequestering coal ash in a cheap spray-on reinforced a fix for the earthquake risk, and maybe that should be a good future environment show.
Oh yeah, we'll talk about that.
Okay, well, find my on the website kbo.fm under Wednesday Talk Radio. You can find a way to email me if you click on my name. And then contact person by email. I'd love to get that. If you could send me that link, that would be great.
Sure.
I'd appreciate it. Okay, thanks, Elliot.
Yeah, all four cheap solutions.
All right. Well, we will revisit this. Perhaps we'll devote a series of programs to this, but try to wrap this up in a way that leads people in a direction that maybe they can do further research, connect up with you, I don't know, do something.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You can find us at portlandassembly.com. I think it's pdxaa.us also. Both of those will route back. Definitely get in contact with us if you're trying to form some mutual aid networks, learn about some neighborhood democracy stuff. You know, we like to do those things. But the focus right now is for sure this issue. And to just because I got such a good setup from that last caller or the one before about New York, it was good. So PERS, right? All these investments are going to Blackstone. What is Blackstone doing? Blackstone just landed a $20 billion deal with Saudi Arabia through, you know, this whole Trump connection thing. Saudi Arabia is going to be broke too, as far as I can tell. They've been squeezing their economy for a long time, repressing their people. We've been kind of propping up the whole royal family over there for a long time, since the 30s with FDR or whatever. But they just entered a $20 billion infrastructure deal. What does that mean? That's $20 billion worth of capital with which they can make derivatives, as far as I could tell. So that is more money than anybody else will have because of the way that multiplier effect works. So our mayor is complicit in this, at least at the level that he has met these people. He has taken money probably from these people. And so, like, this really is about the need to restructure the city governance system, because it's just conducive to this because it's a product of settler colonialism. So in order to get out of this, the only way we'll get out of this is to stop valuing land on this market and figure out a new and better way. And the first thing that you need to do then is bring it back to the rights of the indigenous people who had the land first. Like, there's no way around it. We're there. This is the end of the colonial project in the States, and we got to reconcile. Like, it's time for reparations. There needs to be a reparations project in Portland. Truth and Reconciliation reparations, black construction in Portland would be the only real moral way to handle this. Otherwise, it's going to be it's just going to be a catastrophe. And I would hope that at least then people are, you know, getting together and striking back, because you're literally going to see Space Invader style Wall Street developments taking over your neighborhood. That's what it's going to be.
So we still have a minute and a half.
All right. I mean, we can talk about that, but that's my.
Well, you know, I know, you know, there's a. You know, you had talked about this land trust project in the Bay Area. That's
an
interesting way to go.
Yeah, that's actually a viable model. Like, if we want to talk about real alternatives that you can go bug your city council about tomorrow, land value tax. Tax the amount of value that is raised in the land and put it into something good. Put it into the Indigenous Land Trust. Take that value and put it in the Indigenous Land Trust, just like they're doing with the land tax in the Bay Area with the... Was it Sagawayate, I think? I'm probably butchering that. But if you look that up, the Ohlone Indigenous... people have a land trust in the Bay where you can donate property and you can donate or contribute to the tax, and it goes directly to them. I think a municipally funded model like that is a huge deal if we could pull off something like that. Like, why not Portland? People talk about Portland like it's so progressive. Where is that now, is my question.
And of course, you didn't completely finish the whole unreinforced masonry thing when you started to talk about the historic black churches. You meant to say that those were the kind of building that are being targeted, and many other, the properties that still remain in African American hands, mm-hmm. In Northeast Portland, and are those kind of structures. And as you said, there's a coalition that's fighting back against that. It's a very complex issue that we have touched upon today, but perhaps next month or the month after we'll revisit this issue. So thank you so much, Jonathan, for coming on.
Appreciate you, Paul. Pleasure.
All right. And we got to run. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. Again, look up my page. Get in contact with me if you're inspired, interested, intrigued, got any responses to this program. Wednesday Talk Radio, there's a way to contact me by email on that, or any programmer here on KBOO for that matter. All right. Take care, bye.
Talk about destruction. Folks, don't you can count me in, out, in, out. Be all right. Be all right. Be all right. See, you got a resolution. Well, you know. Well, I'd love to see the flag. You ask for a contribution. Well, you know. Well, I'm doing what we can. One money people mind that, hey. I'll tell you, brother, have to wait. Constitution, well, you know, they don't want to change your head. And act as an institution, well, you know, better free your mind instead. Go kind, pick your chairman, Mao. Gonna make it anyhow.